And now, from the Little Red Songbook of the IWW, there is power in a union, the Joe Hill version.
Would you have freedom from wage slavery? Then join in the grand industrial band. Would you have misery and hunger be free? Then come do your share, lend a hand. There is power in a band of working folk. When they stand, hand in hand,
hand in hand.
That's a power that must rule in every land. One industrial union grand. Would you have mansions of gold in the sky and live in a shack way in the back? Would you have wings up in heaven to fly and starve here with rags on your back? There is power in a band of working folk when they stand
hand in hand.
That's a power that must rule in every land. One industrial union grand. If you like sluggers to beat on your head, then don't organize, all unions despise. If you want nothing before you are dead, shake hands with your boss and look wise. There is power in a band of working folk when they stand hand in hand. That's a power that must rule in every land. One industrial union grand. Come all you workers from every land. Come join in the grand industrial band. Then we our share of this earth shall demand. Come on, do your share, lend a hand. There is power in a band of working folk when they stand hand in hand. That's a power that must rule in every land. One industrial union grand.
Welcome one, welcome all. This is WOB Radio, a production of the Tacoma branch of the Industrial Workers of the World. Going around the table here, fellow worker Lynn is going to lead off in introductions to our fellow members here gathered for the radio.
Hi, thank you. To my left is Marilyn. She's going to tell you about herself.
Hi, I'm Marilyn, and you know that now. I'm a longtime IWW member, and I go by she, they.
My name is fellow worker Noah. I use he, him pronouns. I've been part of the IWW since March of 2021. I've loved my work on WOB Radio the entire time I've been here. I also write for the Seattle Worker, which is a local publication of the Seattle IWW, and the Industrial Worker, which is our main union newspaper. You can find that online at the Industrial Worker.
Hi, listeners and fellow workers. I'm fellow worker Gordon. I live in Bremerton. But I'm a member of the Tacoma General Membership Branch of the Industrial Workers of the World, and I've been a wobbly on and off since 2008. I'm retired from the shipyard in Bremerton, and I'm here to help organize the working class to dismantle capitalism.
I'm Lynn, and I've been part of the IWW for a few years, and I'm really proud of that. And just in case it hasn't been explained, I'm not sure, but every so often I think it's worth saying that WOB Radio means Wobbly Radio, and Wobbly is the IWW, or the Industrial Workers of the World. Just so that we throw these terms around, but maybe you're a new listener and you don't know that. We meet once a month and plan this show, and then once a month we record a show, and we're happy to do this. We're all each very committed to union work and the betterment of all. I guess that's all I have to say. I'm retired, and I used to be in several unions, including AFSCME, and I'll have more on AFSCME later on. But thank you for your listening.
Thank you so much, fellow worker Lynn. Going on, we will now read a section from the preamble to the Constitution of the IWW. The working class and the employing class have nothing in common. There can be no peace so long as hunger and want are found among millions of the working people, and the few who make up the employing class have all the good things of life. Between these two classes, a struggle must go on until the workers of the world organize as a class, take possession of the means of production, abolish the wage system, and live in harmony with the earth. These conditions can be changed and the interest of the working class upheld, only by an organization formed in such a way that all its members in any one industry, or in all industries if necessary, cease work whenever a strike or lockout is on in any department thereof, thus making an injury to one an injury to all. Instead of the conservative motto, a fair day's wage for a fair day's work, we must inscribe on our banner the revolutionary watchword, abolition of the wage system. So, as we do at the start of every episode for all of our new listeners out there, we like to kick things off with labor news. We want to keep you in touch about what's going on in the world of organized labor, whether that's strikes, organizing campaigns, walkouts, things of this nature. The top story that we have here for you today is the ongoing Home in Tacoma campaign, who we hope to have an interview with here in the near future. Home in Tacoma for All has been a campaign that's been going on for well over a year now, I believe. And they are fighting in order to increase renters' protections in the city of Tacoma, protecting them from unjust evictions, sharp increases in rent as we've seen since the COVID-19 pandemic. And they are currently preparing for an initiative vote. So coming up here in November, they have an initiative on the ballot for these renters' protections. For our local city of Tacoma elections, we have an election coming up in November, and this initiative will be on that ballot. We've gone over in previous episodes what those renters' protections are, but there's been more recent actions by Home in Tacoma as well that we'd like to highlight. There was a recent action actually at a apartment complex for a local educator.
Yes, it was Lakewood Landing, and it was a solidarity rally for Kathy Pick. I met Kathy when Teresa McDonald's was run down by that car on the bridge. When she was, we had a rally up there by the Tacoma Dome over a year ago, and a car aimed directly for Teresa McDonald and hit her, injuring her seriously. The purpose of the rally was for people that were experiencing homelessness to support humane treatment and adequate resources for them, and also because people have been upset about the rate hikes for renters. And Teresa was run over, and Kathy Pick, who is an educator, formed a support group to help her through the time of healing. And that's when I met her. She's a wonderful human being. Mm-hmm. And she lives at Lakeside Landing and was served an eviction notice, tried to pay her rent in full, and they would not take it because they had already decided at that point that they wanted her out, not from any behavior on her part, but simply because they want to raise the rents and turn over the clientele that's there.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
From what I've heard, Lakewood Landing is owned by a pretty large multi-billion-dollar investment group.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So it was a really good turnout.
Well, Lakeside?
Lakeside Landing, okay. Yeah.
Yeah, Lakeside Landing, yeah. Anyhow, it was an excellent turnout. All kinds of people there. And we, it was going to storm any minute, but we stayed for well over an hour and reached a lot of people, were able to explain what was going on. Some people in Lakeside Landing had no idea that their rents were about to go up. And so they were shocked and they joined the rally too.
My goodness.
Yeah. So the battle is ongoing on behalf of Kathy Pick and all of the residents there. And go ahead.
Wasn't there some confusion about this initiative? When it first, didn't the city try to confuse that?
Oh, yeah, the city definitely tried to confuse that. So, listener, in case you're not familiar with this, we got enough signatures to get this put on the ballot. We being Tacoma Democratic Socialists of America and several other groups.
Including the UFCW. There was a UFCW here.
Yeah, they came in later. But, yes, they're a very important part of the solidarity. Also, the Lived Experience group was supportive. Many different groups have been supportive of this. So we developed a 10-point initiative and got enough signatures to get it on the ballot, which thoroughly freaked out City Council, which tends to favor developers and the big money. So they immediately came up with a counter measure with a really wonderful title. And it was voted on by them in City Council and adopted, so it already was immediately law. Mm-hmm. And then they decided at the same time that they would put it before the voters The purpose of that was to confuse the voters so that they would vote for the less extreme measure. I'm not going to call it extreme, less efficient measure, the one that less addressed the needs of renters. Well, TDSA sued, and they sued successfully. It came before a judge, and the judge determined after listening that the city of Tacoma had not been acting in good faith since their measure was already law, and that they were trying to confuse the voter, and they could not have it on the ballot this November. So this November, hoping you're a voter, you and you live in Tacoma, you will vote for Proposition 1.
So that'd be a yes on Prop 1.
You got it.
Okay. Yep.
Let's say that again.
Yes on Prop 1.
Yes on Prop 1. And from what I've heard also from the Tacoma Democratic Socialists of America, as well as the Home in Tacoma for All campaign from their Facebook group, is that immediately after this court ruling, the rumblings around town is that a lot of these property investors, the quote-unquote landlord lobby,
$1 million.
Yes, they are currently organizing a ad campaign to the tune of tens of millions of dollars, potentially more, to try and disincentivize voters from voting yes on Prop 1. They're trying to say that these, you know, renters' protections are too extreme. We won't be able to evict, quote-unquote, the right people. You know, it will completely deprive landlords of the power that they have over their own properties. You know, language like this. But again, I think looking forward to November, it's going to be, again, a pretty tough fight, because we are going up against these massive property investors. We are going up against landlords who have risen rent rates in the city of Tacoma by, and I believe that this is the most recent number, by about 40%
rent. 46%.
46% rent increase since about the beginning of
the last 3 years.
Yep. So we are up against a very powerful coalition of well-moneyed people who are trying to keep their abject power over their renters.
The usual suspects, huh?
And spreading misinformation like crazy.
Absolutely. So we definitely want to give a shout out to the Home of Tacoma for All campaign. I, for one, personally am well in support of it. I've been a renter since January of 2020, and even though my experience is not the renter's experience, I certainly recognize that the abject power that landlords have over people who need housing in order to survive is far too great. So that is the current update from Home in Tacoma for All. Like I said earlier, we really hope to get them on the radio soon and have an interview with them. We have interviewed them several episodes ago when they were initially kicking up their campaign.
We'll be glad to do interviews.
Absolutely. So moving on to our next point of news here, the writer's strike has come to a tentative agreement down in California. This is pretty big. We've reported on this a couple of times since the writer's strike began down in California. There were up to hundreds of thousands of people on strike. A lot of these writers' groups for big shows, such as the Drew Barrymore show being one of them, but also the major Hollywood production studios, especially around the Hollywood area. So the SAG, I believe it's SAG-AFTRA, and the Hollywood studios have come to a tentative agreement. The writers, as far as I've been able to see from the news, have yet to vote on that agreement. So things are still up in the air as to whether or not the strike could rekindle. However, the good news from this tentative agreement is that the studios have agreed to the gross, gross majority of the strikers' demands. So this was a very successful strike. It was the writers. My apologies, fellow listeners. What was the name of the writers' union? Does anyone remember?
Writers Guild of America.
Yes, thank you. The Writers Guild of America and the major Hollywood studios have reached a tentative agreement. Thank you for that correction. I believe the actors' strike is still ongoing, and they have yet to reach...
That's what I heard, too.
They have yet to reach a tentative agreement between the unions and the studios. So the writers are getting a pretty big boost from this. Like I said earlier, all
they
of their...
They certainly needed the protection.
Mm-hmm. They have employment, better employment protections. They have wage increases in order for them to afford to live where they work.
What about those that residuals issue they were worried about? In other words, being able to, for the, whoever's using their writing, whoever's using the scripts, to just sort of keep them and not give residual payments to the writers.
So this is an article from CNN Business, so, you know, take it with a grain of salt. It is the capitalist media after all. The negotiators for the Writers Guild of America and heads of major media companies are set to return to the table after a productive day of talks. But filming of movies and shows still wouldn't be able to resume unless the union representing the actors also reaches a deal. So the studios are still locked down by this strike. the bosses of the four major companies, Warner Brothers, Discovery, Disney, and Netflix, as well as NBC Universal, joined negotiations with the WGA, which represents more than 11,000 writers. Afterwards, the union, the Alliance of Motion Picture and Television Producers, which represents management, issued a rare joint statement. While it only disclosed the second day of the talks, a person familiar with the matter told CNN that the Wednesday talks left attendees feeling encouraged. So, to kind of get to a brief summary of their demands, both between actors and writers, they had a similar set of demands, including better wages, residuals payments from streaming services for their work, like fellow worker Gordon mentioned, and job protections against the use of artificial intelligence, which we've also discussed on the show.
But that's not validated for the actors at all yet.
No, the actors are still on strike.
And so they could use AI, potentially, to create characters instead of hiring.
You see that in advertising, though. Yeah. I've started noticing that.
And that's huge.
And I'm probably really late to notice it, but some of the people are real, and then they'll have ones that are not real people. It's scary.
Well,
to think that's melding us.
I'm going to go ahead and throw in a bit of a caveat. As we've discussed before, this AI technology is pretty cutting edge, but it's still being developed. You can kind of, you know, this is kind of a joke amongst people who create or try to, you know, sell off AI-created art, is that you can kind of tell it's made by a computer. It has that uncanny valley kind of artistic representation. I've kind of seen that in movies as well. For example, if you remember the movie Rogue One, it was a Star Wars story that came out a few years ago. They had put the portrayal of Princess Leia into the film after... oh my gosh, I'm forgetting her. After Carrie Fisher passed away. So they did use AI, essentially, and computer technology to put her in the film post-mortem. Post-mortem, yeah.
Wow, I didn't know that.
But
that's
you could
pretty ghoulish.
But it was very realistic.
Yeah, you can tell at this point, but as you said, it's in the stages of development.
Mm-hmm.
And further, the issue is the actors getting paid for the work they do.
Including the residuals.
Being able to get jobs. Mm-hmm. Because if they just cut out the actors.
Right. And it depends on your individual contract instead of on a union contract. So if you're an actor, most actors that I've known are not big-time stars. If they get gigs, they're small. They're not very well paid.
Walk-ons.
They're sort of walk-ons or extras. And every town, every city that I've ever been in has
very
a little theater group.
Very difficult to make a living doing that.
That's right. Mm-hmm. But what I'm saying is that... if I've been a lifelong aspirant to be an actor and somebody offers me a contract for $10,000, which sounds like a lot of money to me now, because it is, but I could be tempted to take that. Mm-hmm. And then forever after, my biometrics have been stored and my, you know, facial expressions and all this stuff. And it's a frightening concept.
It is.
So the reason why the strike was so successful wasn't just because of the solidarity between the actors and the writers. It was also because they were willing to strike for so long in order to make a financial cost against the companies who were not trying to pay them and protect them as they should have. This is again from CNN Business. The work stoppage has been costly, especially to the economies in Southern California and New York. The strike has cost more than $5 billion already, and Discovery, the owner of CNN, reported to investors that now the strike has stretched into the fall and expects it will cost the company up to $500 million by the end of the year. Mm. So this is kind of the power of striking and why scabbing on your fellow workers tends to undercut that is because scabs obviously keep the profits moving for the companies whose workers are on strike. But this strike has been so successful because there was a huge amount of solidarity across all of these studios. Speaking of which... that solidarity, funny enough, has actually made the unionization campaigns in the entertainment industry more successful. There were two different animation studios that organized unanimously. Unfortunately, I don't have the article pulled up on my computer at the moment, but there was a video games graphics design company that works for some pretty big AAA games producers. Their animators successfully unionized, and it was a unanimous vote. And then there was another animation studio as well, I believe in Southern California, that also had a unanimous unionization vote as well. So a lot of the people who do animation or for video games or even for movies, they're starting to organize as well. So Woo-hoo! The solidarity of this is bleeding out into other sectors of the entertainment industry.
Well, we as IWWs have always maintained, always, that acts of solidarity go way beyond what our, for instance, the IWW's actual membership is not astronomical, but our influence has spread throughout the labor movement over the time that we've existed. Mm-hmm. And so, what do they call it? When our influence is greater than our actual numbers, this works for everyday working people, if you're union or not.
It's the ripple effect, I think.
Okay, I'll go with that. Because just setting an example, I was very much inspired by the Amazon workers in Staten Island. That's my home city, it's New York. So I knew where they were talking about and what they were talking about. And so that had a tremendous effect on marginally employed or precariously employed workers everywhere. And they gave a lot of courage to a lot of other workers. So it's very inspirational. Mm-hmm.
These are very good times for union organizing.
It is. I mean, it's always tough, and you're always going to have the expected pushback, I think, from the wealthy capitalists that control the industries of today. But I think the fact that, and I guess this is surprising to me, because I never really saw this kind of stuff when I was younger. It wasn't until, you know, right before the COVID pandemic, I started to focus on labor history and labor organizing and stuff like that. But I mean, the amount of strikes and solidarity from the early 2000s when I was growing up to now is a huge rift, and you're definitely right. I mean, this massive increase in unionization across the country in multiple different industries is just, it's a sign of the times. People aren't getting paid enough in order to make ends meet. The housing crisis continues to deprive people of housing because wealthy housing investors and landlords are depriving tenants of their
earnings. People know the power of solidarity.
Mm-hmm. Speaking of more solidarity, our next labor news article here that we have is the United Auto Workers Union, which has rapidly expanded its strike across well over a couple baker's dozens different locals across the country in the auto industry. This is also from CNN Business, and this article was published September 29th, so it was just at the end of last month. The United Auto Workers Union is expanding its strike to one additional assembly plant, each at Ford and General Motors. But it said progress in talks at Stellantis was keeping the union from expanding the picket lines there. UAW President Sean Fain, love the man, said the new facilities that will go on strike at noon Friday are Ford's Chicago Assembly Plant, which makes the Ford Explorer and Lincoln Aviator SUVs, and GM's Lansing Delta Township Assembly Plant in Michigan, which makes the Chevrolet Traverse and Buick Enclave SUVs. With those additional 7,000 members picking up picket signs, the total number of striking UAW members across all three automakers will reach over 25,000. So this is huge. Union had said all along it had planned to expand the reach of the strike to increase pressure on the companies if it wasn't satisfied with the progress of negotiations.
Just to comment on that, I like the the carrot and stick approach that the UAW has taken. In other words, they're showing the other automakers, look, Stellantis cooperated with us on this. And we're not striking them, or at least we haven't expanded our strike. So, you know, like, take a lesson.
Mm-hmm.
And I love that because it shows that it's not only the power to withdraw our labor from an employer, it's also the power to reward better employers. There are better and worse employers. So by rewarding Stellantis, by punishing GM and Ford, it sent a very strong political message.
Mm-hmm. Negotiate or things will get harder for your net profits.
Exactly. And when you do, we'll be nice.
So,
excellent perspective.
In terms of the negotiations, the three companies are on record each offering the union an immediate raise at least 10% for the 145,000 UAW members at the companies and another 10 percentage points of general wage increases over the life of the proposed deal, which is due to run through to the spring of 2028. But the union is seeking significantly larger wage increases, as well as improved pension and health care benefits, reversing concessions in 2007 and 2009 when the automakers were all facing financial distress, and both GM and Stellantis predecessor Chrysler were on their way to bankruptcy and federal bailouts. So now the companies are earning record or near-record profits, and the union is demanding record contracts accordingly.
Mm-hmm. Also, the end of the tier wage system.
Yeah.
This is a thing that had revolution built into it. There's nothing like working across the assembly line or next to somebody on the assembly line who's doing the same job you're doing and getting half of your pay. That would make me feel pretty bad. And it definitely makes the newer employee feel pretty bad. So I think one of the UAW's key demands is the end to the tiered wage system.
I mean, it also pits workers against each other, because you can imagine the kind of friction you would have in a workplace where, like you said, you're working next to somebody who's on a different tier system and is earning probably enough to live comfortably next to you, who might just be able to get by every few paychecks.
No pension, no benefits.
I think probably one of the bigger part of this strike in the news is that President Biden visited the picket line, which, considering his actions towards the rail unions, which I'm personally pretty salty about, I think that that is a good change of course for him. And this is the first president to ever do that in history.
I think he knew he had to do it after his fiasco with the railroads.
Yeah, I think that, I mean, it will certainly help him in terms of the PR campaign. I mean, I don't even want to think about the upcoming presidential election in 2024. But still, I think it's really good that the president visited the picket line, because I think it sets a good standard for who we want in power for the time being. Do we want someone who is at least vocally supportive of unionization efforts, of the strikes, or do we want another executive in office who is
very hostile.
Hostile, blatantly hostile? I mean, I remember during the Trump administration, a lot of the labor board was essentially filled with some pretty blatantly anti-union people and slowed down a lot of progress for people who were trying to organize their workplace. So, congratulations to the UAW. Speaking of which, there was actually a recent solidarity rally just a few days ago down by City Hall with the UAW and a couple other locals as well. Getting people aware of what's going on with the strike and how it might continue to expand. Moving on to our next labor news story here. Speaking of IWW-related news, we have a news article out from California. The Three Pete's Cafes organized with us. Three Pete's Cafes organized with the IWW in California, and this is out of our national newsletter, theindustrialworker.org. The Three Pete's Coffee Shops in Berkeley and Oakland, California, won their campaign to form a union with the industrial workers of the world. On June 9th, the workers filed their demand for a union election for the stores at 2051 Telegraph Avenue in Berkeley and at 4050 Piedmont Avenue and 5095 Avenue in Oakland. They endured a month of anti-union tactics. However, the inoculation of the union to the lies of the bosses worked. The National Labor Relations Board certified the victory for each store on July 27th, 2023. The campaign kicked off in February of 2023, initially inspired by a victory by another union. So again, solidarity bleeding out into other workplaces. There was news that the Pete store in Davis unionized with the SEIU. Curious, the workers asked the SEIU for help. However, they did not reach an understanding with the food and services union affiliated with the AFL-CIO. In contrast, the industrial workers of the world treated them with more respect and practical help. Quote, when we talked to the IWW, they immediately started helping us, answering our questions about the whole process, and they helped us a lot with all the paperwork. They take great care of us, and they are teaching us a lot about the process. We really like to know everything that is happening, unquote. The treatment of the employees does not respect the needs of the employees, according to one of the workers, Alondra. Quote, they don't care much about the employees at work. There are a lot of people who hurt their hands, their shoulders, doing the job. We have to spend hours at these drink machines. Sometimes there is no one to come to help us because we don't have enough employees. Also, the training isn't good. There are Three Pete's Cafes down in Northern California that organized with the IWW. Of course, all solidarity and congratulations to them. We've talked before about how the IWW, one of its earlier bigger campaigns in the 2000s, I should say early 2000s, was we tried to organize Starbucks at the time.
Yes.
And it looks like a lot of that labor history and a lot of the tactics that were learned from that campaign looks like was used in this campaign as well.
Indeed.
It's not Starbucks. I mean, all love to the Starbucks Workers Union. I know that they're with the AFL-CIO now, but I mean, this is pretty cool. I think that there are a lot of smaller cafe and drink chains that are still viable for organization as well. And it's good that the IWW and these workers got to work together on that. So,
and like we mentioned earlier, as IWWs, we're not competing for red cards. In other words, we don't base our ideology or our success on how many members we can sign up. We base our ideology and our success on what good we do for the working class in general. And so our ideas, if you want to adopt our ideas without taking out a red card, go for it. But just, you know, be sure to remember that spirit of solidarity. And, you know, I'm just doing a shout out for us. but I'm also doing a shout out for people who picked up the banner, who picked up the fallen banner, if you will, and moved on with some of these principles in mind.
Fellow worker Lynn, you were going to tell us a little bit about San Juan County going to a 32 hours a week work schedule.
Yes, this announcement is rare, and it's historically like almost unprecedented. The Island County, Washington, they voted and they approved a 32-hour work week with no reduction in pay.
Woohoo!
And no extra duties. There's been studies. It's happened in other cities and a few other governments. I don't know which other counties or cities. But anyway, it's more common in Europe, for example, and other countries. But anyway, they found that productivity goes up. People are happier. They have more time, discretionary time, mm-hmm. in their life. And they give more. They have that same quota for the week. And with pride, they do it. And then just another couple of... and the details about it. This workers include nurses, road crew, parks employees, environmental stewards, clerks, and others. 70% of the workforce of that county are covered by this new 32-hour work week. Yeah, so studies have shown that there's more efficiency with that. And then I just had a couple of thoughts regarding unions. If we could ever get health care for all and or Medicare for all, unions could then really negotiate. We wouldn't have to have that huge piece of the health care, which is so expensive, and it's just such a wedge between labor and management, I mean, among others. And it just would be great to not have that burden of that. It's just so ridiculous that this country has that form of, you know, privatized health care. Health care, in quotes. Anyway, end of my rant. Oh, the other thing is that I'm sitting across from one of the best bumper stickers ever. The labor movement, the folks who brought you the weekend.
Absolutely. And with this 32-hour arrangement, they might be able to get one more day on that weekend, right?
Really, really.
Exactly. And for, I know that there's going to be some listeners out there saying, oh, so great. So now my garbage is only going to get picked up 4 days a week, or I can't go to the DMV and get my, or the DOL and get my license renewed. No, that's not the case. We're talking 32 hours for 40 hours pay, and the normal agreements about overtime and holiday pay. These are normal agreements, time and a half on Sunday, on holidays, this kind of thing. So it's a scheduling problem, not a service problem.
Very good point.
I would also like to jump in here as well, that the IWW has been talking about shortening the work week for a very long time, basically since our inception in 1905.
Yep.
One of our popular slogans was towards a four-hour day.
Yep.
On the concept that, you know, having shorter work days while maintaining the pay, it increases employment first and foremost, like you said. You know, having a 32-hour work week means that there is more time availability to have maybe overlapping shifts, mm-hmm. or a creation of whole new shifts. That means more people who want to work in those industries can actually get employed.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's one of the major downsides of the 40-hour system, is that it basically means the workers that are there have to work more, but it deprives other people from being able to get employment at those places,
yeah.
because there's not enough hours for them to actually be hired on, whether that's full-time or part-time. And like you said, I've actually seen some of those studies, fellow worker Lynn, about four-day work weeks. It increases worker productivity, amongst everything else. Workers are actually happier with their place of work and the work that they do. Having a shorter work week doesn't mean that their total income has to suffer. And I've always believed in the philosophy that, and maybe this is just me going on my little rant here, if you can do 8 hours of work within a 6 hour or even 4 hour time frame, you should get paid for 8 hours. You know what I mean? I feel like in a lot of workplaces and a lot of different industries, there's just a lot of time at work, and this is also from my personal experience as well, there's a lot of time at work where you're just kind of doing nothing productive, but you always have to feel like you're doing productive. You always have to look, you know, look busy, or, you know, do this little nonsense task until the next actual task comes
along. Or they keep beating the productivity drum and raising the productivity expectation.
Mm-hmm.
Every time you meet it, they raise it. And, you know, the whole myth was that when computers were invented, when the industrial age happened, all of these different things, that it would liberate fellow workers to not have to work so many hours and still live a good quality of life. Well, where has that gone? So I'm very glad to hear that they have instituted this, and hopefully more counties will do that. And more cities will do that.
Hopefully our city. I'd love to see that in Tacoma. I mean, if you can get the renter's protections through the Home and for All, Home in Tacoma for All campaign, fingers crossed. I mean, why can't we go to a 30-hour work week? I just can't make sense of it. And to tip on your point as well, like you said, you know, management beats the drum of trying to get more out of your 8 hours. Now we're, what, doing 12 hours worth of labor in an 8-hour time?
Well, and with cell phones, now you're constantly available.
Mm-hmm. You're on the clock all the time.
Yeah. I mean, we've lost our lives.
Mm-hmm. Fellow worker Lynn, you had another comment?
Oh, just that I don't think that when I was talking about the 32-hour work week that I, again, mentioned the union that this is through, that bargained this, is the AFSCME, and that's American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees.
Good.
So I just wanted to shout out to them.
Yeah, absolutely. I've had a couple friends work for AFSCME previously, and some of them still, whether that's in social services or other governmental institutions, and they can really tip their hat to that union because they do have great solidarity and great militancy amongst their ranks to organize for what they need. So hats off to them, absolutely. The 32-hour work week needs to come to this country. And now for a book review by fellow worker Gordon. Gordon, what books are you reviewing for this episode?
I'm just going to review one this episode, and the book title is Under the Iron Heel. And it's written by Professor Ahmed White, who teaches at Berkeley. And it's University of California Press. And the subtitle for Under the Iron Hill is The Wobblies and the Capitalist War on Radical Workers. Now, I just want to stress that this is a history book, and so it can get tedious with a lot of statistics. However, this professor writes very accessibly. And by that, I mean that he mixes in cultural and newsworthy items of the day. He's not narrowly focused on one subject, although, of course, the emphasis is on the IWW, specifically out west for the most part. However, he looks at the union as a whole. And like any good history book, it's got an introduction, and the introduction basically encapsulates what his goal is for writing this book. And in the introduction, he gives a thumbnail sketch of the IWW, the Industrial Workers of the World, and he rounds that out with the laws that were being enacted at the time, notably criminal syndicalism laws. And these went state by state. At its height, 20 states, 2 territories, and many cities had what they called criminal syndicalism laws. Now, syndicalism is just a fancy word for unionism, and it's of European origin. And, of course, everybody who's watched Monty Python and the Holy Grail has heard of the anarcho-syndicalist commune, where they collect filth over there in England. But anyway, it's a real word. Anarcho-syndicalism just refers to that branch of syndicalism or unionism that has anarchists or anarchist philosophy at its core. There are many kinds of unionism. We've discussed it on the show before. Principally, we've drawn the difference between industrial unionism and trade and craft unionism. And as we know, industrial unionism, as we've discussed, organizes an entire industry regardless of trade, regardless of skill. Our little outfit always uses the airline industry as an example of what that is, which would be the pilots, the flight attendants, the mechanics, the baggage handlers, everybody in the same union. So we all negotiate, regardless as to our skill level. Now, in this first couple of chapters, the author claims that the criminal syndicalist laws were specifically crafted to destroy the IWW. It reached out and it hit other organizations, notably socialist organizations like the Socialist Party of Eugene Debs, Socialist Workers Party, later on the Communist Party, and various outfits. Oh, Black Nationalists was another target. They rolled pretty much everybody on the left into this one category, but their specific aim, according to the author, was to destroy the IWW, and it is his further contention that it did. I have a little bit of difference with the professor's opinion, but I respect it, and he lays out a pretty convincing case. He's talking about outright repression of the union by a coalition of businessmen, professionals, wannabe patriots, local toughs, as he calls them, or like street gang people, college students, police, and soldiers. And they always seem to coalesce around fighting the IWW and other progressive organizations, but mostly the IWW. They would ransack our union halls. They designed laws to lock us up. Also, in the first chapter or two, the author clarifies the term sabotage.
Excuse me.
This is a loaded term, even within our union today.
Can you repeat the term?
Sabotage. Hmm. It comes from the French S-A-B-O-T, sable, which means shoe. And it refers to the Luddite practice of throwing wooden shoes into factory gears and mill works to disable the machinery, because the Luddites believed their jobs were being taken, and rightfully so. Their jobs were being taken by the first bugaboo for the working class, which was automation. So they tried to wreck the machinery. That didn't work out too well. But he clarified the term sabotage as to how the IWW was using it. And it's pretty important. It gets a lot of wobblies upset, either for or against. But anyway, what the IWW, specifically Elizabeth Gurley Flynn and Tresca and a couple of other people, when they referred to sabotage, they referred to the hindrance of the ability for the employer to make a profit. And they used tactics like work to rule, slow down, this kind of thing. They didn't mean actually destroying machinery, although the professor does note that some incidents of these things happening did occur. Like any other outfit, IWW has had fringe elements that believe in things like physical sabotage, but as a union policy, it was eschewed and it was defined. And there were a lot of pamphlets out about it, what it meant. Troutman wrote a pamphlet about it. Walker Smith wrote a pamphlet about it. So you can look into that term, because it turns a lot of people off, frankly, and they used it back in the day. And by back in the day, I mean 1917. The guy has the professor had a specific time frame to make his thesis, and that was 1917 to 1924. Also, the title refers to the title of a novel by Jack London.
Which I'm reading.
Pardon me?
Which I'm reading right
now. It's an excellent novel. It's a little melodramatic, but he writes in the tone of the day, which is the, you know, late 1800s, early 1900s. Mm-hmm. And also, Jack London's work was admired throughout the IWW, and he was studied at IWW halls and in lectures. So he notes this all through the book, which is a good thread. It makes the book very readable, accessible, because anybody who's read Jack London, Call of the Wild, or any of that stuff, and gets excited about it, will understand why the Wobblies admired Jack so much. So he was talking about the ferment of the day. The political ferment of the day had its roots in socialism, and the differences between what the AFL did and the IWW did as far as organizing methods. He said the IWW was composed largely of immigrants, black workers, and transients, native-born transients, following the work across the country, like the wheat harvest, or, you know, fruit harvests, or wherever there was work, people would migrate. And he also mentioned the IWW's embrace of direct action and revolution at the point of production, meaning on the factory floor, or in the wheat field, or in the hop field. So he gives very specific, the bulk of the book is methods employed by the ruling class to repress the union. And it gets very specific, and it gets pretty gruesome sometimes. The conditions back in prisons 100 years or plus ago were not even marginally better than the conditions today. They were brutal. A lot of people caught diseases, were beaten to death. Were enslaved practically in many of the federal and state prisons, and he goes into great detail about that. So if you're not a history buff and don't like a lot of statistics, you can just kind of skip to the last few chapters. And he talks about harassment laws in chapter 6 specifically. He talks about vagrancy laws, which is like an excuse to just scoop people up off the street, much like driving while black is today. It's just an excuse to pull you over because you fit the description. But anyway, it got its start a long time ago. And also, the ferment of wartime. Remember, Woodrow Wilson was supposedly the president that kept us out of war. Well, in 1917, he got us into the war. And that gave him all kinds of executive power, ability to nationalize strategic industries, regulate profits and wage scales and arrest people if they mentioned anything that would, if I was an anti-war person back in the day, I could get thrown into prison for being a seditionist. So he developed that. The criminal syndicalism laws, the Sedition Act, the Espionage Act, and then the subsequent Red Scare, which happened under A. Mitchell Palmer, the Attorney General, and J. Edgar Hoover, another familiar name to people of a certain generation. And right here locally, seven Wobblies were convicted of murder for the Centralia tragedy of 1919 and were sent to Walla Walla Prison, which must have been, a great place to go like it is today, in 1921. And a lot of these guys stayed in prison for years and years. Their lawyer got disbarred. And just as a brief segue to what's going on right now with that situation, we've got a monument already designed and cast. We're going to be doing a dedication ceremony on the 11th of November in Centralia. And we've also written a letter to the governor of the state of Washington to get all these guys who were convicted fully pardoned. It's definitely posthumous, but it clears their name in the history books as far as being set up and railroaded into prison just for having a red card. And once again, the author goes into just having a red card could get you thrown into jail after a while. And as a matter of fact, three organizations were on the criminal syndicalist list of subversive organizations, and I'm proud to say that the last liberal president, Richard Nixon, lifted these criminal syndicalism laws because they're unconstitutional. And the three organizations were the CPUSA, Communist Party United States of America, the Socialist Workers Party, and the IWW, because we were the original reason for them to make these laws. And the only reason CPUSA and the Trots, the Socialist Workers Party, got involved in it is because they tried to form industrial union organizations on their own. And the author gets into that later history, and he draws some disturbing conclusions for me anyway, and that is he contends that for all intents and purposes, 1924 marked the demise of the industrial workers of the world. I disagree with that historically, but I think I understand his point. Because he goes in, he briefly mentions, you know, some of the good work that's being done today, and he briefly mentions our participant, the current IWW, who he has praise for, because, you know, he admires us for our dogged determination to organize according to the original principles. He doesn't think much of our success, but that's okay. We're working on it. So anyway, that's what I wanted to point out, is that it can be, if you're on the left, if you claim to be a revolutionary or just a radical trade unionist or anything of that stripe, the book can kind of make you depressed because, it's all over. But it isn't. A new chapter is being written, and you can help write it. So you can get this book through the IWW store, iww.org. Just go to the little store icon. They might still have some in stock. Or you can look up some of the usual suspects like AK Press or PM Press, or Charles Kerr. So look them up. Oh, the name of the book is Under the Iron Heel, and it refers to the title of the Jack London novel. It is by Professor Ahmed White of the University of California at Berkeley.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Gordon, because your enthusiasm there is really contagious. Books are powerful, powerful things, aren't they?
Good books.
Yeah, must be why so many books are getting banned. So I had just a little lateral thing that I wanted to add.
Sure.
So I found this, and I just want to read it briefly. Did you know John Steinbeck's Depression-era classic, The Grapes of Wrath, is among the top 100 books banned in America? I can see why. Here's a short passage from chapter 25. There is a crime here that goes beyond denunciation. There is a sorrow here that weeping cannot symbolize. There is a failure here that topples all our successes. The fertile earth, the straight tree rows, the sturdy trunks, and the ripe fruit. And the children dying of hunger must die because of a profit cannot be taken from an orange. And coroners must fill in the certificates, died of malnutrition, because the food must rot
if not sold at a profit. And in the eyes of the hungry, there is a growing wrath. In the souls of the people, the grapes of wrath are filling and growing heavy for the vintage. And that was back during the Depression era.
Mm-hmm.
No wonder it's a banned book.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And you're going to see more banned books.
Yeah. I wonder when this one's going to get banned. I mean, you know, if you can't even talk about LGBT-related topics in a child-friendly way, or if you can't talk about, you know, racism and racial struggles in this country
right.
in a child-friendly way, I mean, it's only a matter of time when things that even so much as remotely criticize capitalism or how capitalists have lashed back at workers like this book does. I can only imagine that's going to make it onto a list sometime soon.
With a sense of perverse gratitude,
mm-hmm.
I can only say that I'm glad many of our opponents will never hear of the book.
Absolutely.
And couldn't read it if they
didn't. Yeah. If there's one thing that the anti-intellectual reactionaries don't get, it's the fact that they don't even understand the content they're banning in the first place.
That's right.
I think I need to set up a little banned book library, lending library out front here.
You should.
What a good idea.
Yeah.
Or just disperse them to little free libraries. I mean, I'm sure this thing would fly off the shelves.
Yeah.
Absolutely. I've heard a lot of good things about this book, and I've been meaning to read it as well.
Mm-hmm.
I definitely agree with you, Gordon. The criticism that Professor White has in terms of describing the IWW as having significantly died off around 1924. I know the history behind that personally and from my own research. I definitely get where he's coming from. We had a huge membership loss. The IWW briefly split between a more politically oriented faction mm-hmm. and the more originalist faction, which continues today through our organization. There was a great time of strife for our organization. The capitalists, I hate to say it, kind of won in that sense. But on the other hand, I think it's our determination to survive and to continue organizing as an organization,
definitely.
Even with only a fraction of the membership that we used to have, speaks to our power and really speaks to our values as well.
And as has been noted earlier in the broadcast and in previous episodes, our influence is greater than our numbers.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
I thought it was very interesting when you talked about it the IWW being really put down by college campuses,
mm-hmm.
because one thing that the IWW has always done is try to use layman's language, understandable
right.
by all, and that might have been seen as a threat to jargon users in universities and colleges.
Well, actually, they recruited college boys and not girls, because there weren't too many college girls back then.
Uh-huh.
They recruited college boys as being scions of wealthy families,
mm-hmm.
and that it was in their class interest. They appealed to an intellectual side
mm.
of reaction.
Quote, unquote, intellectual.
I'm seeing air quotes go off like fireworks over mm-hmm. here, fellow worker.
I'll keep
Noah.
My fingers down.
But you're right. They were, if you were going to college back 110 years ago, you were paying big money,
mm-hmm.
and they had a ranking, you know, that went from the Ivy League, you know, down to your state colleges, down to,
but you were members of the club.
Yes.
There's more air quotes.
Indeed. Well, it's part of the ruling class. So yeah. they would recruit college boys just like they would recruit servicemen to go out and bust heads.
Yeah. They meaning the ruling class.
The ruling class,
the
local Rotary Club, the local Chamber of Commerce, the business interests.
Yeah.
And they would ally. Of course, there were cops, but of course, they needed some bully boys. So you go down to the saloon. That was the reason for the Everett Massacre, was that they deputized guys out of the saloons.
Mm-hmm.
You know, here's a gun. We're going to be beating up on these wobblies, right?
Meet here at five, yeah.
Yeah, well, that's what he was calling local toughs, okay?
Yeah.
Kind of an archaic phrase, but I got where he was coming from. In other words, today's, you know, maybe motorcycle enthusiasts or
the local security company that the company hires.
Or a really serious paintball outfit.
Yeah.
But you get where I'm coming from. Mm-hmm. They recruited among their class interest, and that would include, you know, police, guys who knocked heads, scabs,
yeah.
union busters, along with college boys and military officers.
It sounds like a really fascinating book.
It's very readable. That's what I'm getting at. Now, this is a very fascinating book, too, Wobblies on the Waterfront, and that is a more specific IWW history. But it's not half as readable because it is statistic heavy.
Mm-hmm.
And I can get through it because I'm interested in that kind of stuff.
Would you be willing to do that for our next book report?
Wobblies on the Waterfront?
Yeah.
I'd be very happy to.
Alrighty. Look forward to that, fellow listeners. We have a roundtable discussion now, and this is something that we've been working on locally as a branch, but also just kind of taking a look at how other unions organize and interact with their membership. I was wondering if maybe we could talk a little bit about encouraging pro-union workers and union members about, you know, participating more in their union locals, how we can best reach out to, whether that's people who have pro-union sentiments but aren't organized or a member of a union, or union members who are paying their dues and are on paper very in for the very much for the union that they're represented by, but maybe who don't have enough initiative on their own part to kind of contribute.
Or maybe there's something else going on.
Yep. Well, yeah, absolutely. I think that there are many reasons why, you know, and you've touched on this before, Gordon, there's a difference between membership and what we get done. With a lot of the larger trade and craft unions, especially for the last several decades of the 20th century, they definitely grew in numbers and they grew in union locals, but they kind of stagnated when it came to getting wins from their organizing, things like better wages, hours, conditions, and so on. Mm-hmm. So I think that this is an interesting discussion because I think that if we did have more unionized workers or pro-union people joining unions and then getting more involved, I think that that would be a massive benefit to the labor movement. And I guess the question, the open-ended question for the table is, how do we better motivate our membership to actually contribute? And what strategies can we use in order to bring more union folks to the actual table?
One of the strategies that we're employing right now, which is getting the word out. We've mentioned several times, now you have to be a little bit careful. If you want to, let's say we see a UAW picket is going up at a car dealership or something, or some other kind of union action is going to be happening, and you want to support them, and you're not busy that day, right? Sometimes you could be stepping on toes, because AFL-CIO unions often scab on each other. They have jurisdictional fights. They don't want to see a machinist at a Teamster rally, you know, that kind of thing. But as IWWs, we're kind of the bad boys and girls of the labor movement. We have that historical cachet. People know of us, and I have never been turned away from a picket line. If you approach the leaders of the picket, usually the guy or gal with the bullhorn, and say, "Hi, I'm from the IWW. I would like to walk your picket line in solidarity." They'll hand you a sign, and you get to walk with your union brothers and sisters wearing your IWW t-shirt, as long as you're carrying their signage. You can't bring the IWW on strike, because it's not, you know, they're on strike. But you can carry their signage, and you can wear your regalia, if you will. And I've never been rejected. I've walked
I've always been welcomed.
Yes, I've walked a few picket lines.
They've been very happy to have the support.
Yes.
And you can also certainly show up with pizza for people that are marching.
That's another.
You know, DSA just had the same conversation, how to support and lend solidarity and how to build the union.
Food and water. That's why they banned it down south or in certain locations in the country for people waiting in line to vote.
Exactly.
It's illegal to give an old person a bottle of water or a place to sit down or something like that. It's illegal now? Mm-hmm. Okay, well, that's the kind of tactics they're going to descend to when it comes to the labor movement, too.
Well, I think the point about reaching out to other unions and being there for their struggles.
Yes.
Carrying their signs, but also letting them know that you are the IWW.
That's right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I think in terms of membership participation, I think that doing those actual direct actions, whether that's walking a picket line or feeding and hydrating the people who are walking those picket lines, I think that's fantastic.
There's more, though. Because I have a bunch of ideas. And one of them, you know, I belong to a lot of different groups, and I'm in solidarity.
You're a busy woman, Marilyn.
Well, I think it's important to be. People have told me, you belong to too many groups, you should pick one. And I tell them that's like picking one child of your three or four. You know, they all matter. So I feed them all. I feed all the groups. TDSA is really good about having regular socializing times.
Who's that?
Tacoma Democratic Socialists.
Yeah. Okay. They meet down the street at a little restaurant bar. They have regular potlucks. They have regular times that are outside of the regular meeting time.
Mm.
And it happens frequently during the month where people get together and just build relationship.
Mm-hmm.
If you build relationships, people will come.
And you are currently listening to Radio Tacoma 101.9 FM KTAH.
Solidarity forever, for the union makes us
very brief report back about something I remembered, that one of our IWW members out in Bremerton organized on her own a kids day.
Yeah.
And I volunteered to, you know, set up a canopy and have a blanket on the ground so that kids could come in out of the sun and maybe read a kid's book. And they provided all the books, and there were activities. There was bubble blowing. There was clowns that showed up. And a couple of hundred people from the neighborhood showed up with their children. And it was an enormous success. So shout out to fellow worker Kit and the fellow workers at Bremerton for doing just this kind of activity.
Exactly.
It publicizes us, you know, but it also is a direct benefit to the community.
Absolutely. You know, I think that having those community events or even just membership social events, like you said, they on one hand, they build community. On the other hand, they build relationships at the same time.
And listener, we're sitting around the table here that you can't see, but we always have lunch before we start our program just to visit and catch up with each other. Fellow worker Lynn always brings food. I provide my place because Radio Tacoma doesn't have a building, but we build relationships here. We're all really close friends. I'm also looking around my room, and I have something up on the wall there, Wobbly Fest.
Yeah.
Now, I don't remember what year that was from, but it was certainly in the 80s or 90s, where we had a two-day gathering at the Evergreen Tacoma site. We provided all these different workshops. We provided daycare. We provided food. And we just had a great time, and we learned too, and we had good participation.
We should do another Wobbly Fest at some point. I think that'd be pretty fun to organize.
Yeah, I know that
our union outfit has definitely started to grow in terms of its relations to other organizations here in Tacoma as well, which I'd also like to touch on, which is that I think that one way that we can kind of not just increase membership, but just increase participation in the community, assisting other working people in their lives, is to actually kind of get together with other like-minded organizations. I know that we have several people in our branch who are part of the TDSA or who have friends who are part of the TDSA. And I've really appreciated that kind of crossover of here's two revolutionary organizations learning from each other and in support of each other, not competition.
Right. Yeah. Mm-hmm. In solidarity. And also we have a pretty good regional publication. Fellow worker Noah is a frequent contributor to the Seattle Worker.
And I just got updated to editor recently.
Wow! Yay. Congratulations.
Thank you.
So this is a local 6-page newsletter that comes out bi-monthly. But anyway, it's a local publication. It's printed out of the Seattle branch's budget. It comes out every couple of months. But anyway, it's free to workers, and you can find it distributed out in Kitsap County, and you can find it distributed in Seattle. And the Tacoma branch usually gets a bundle. So it's a very good publication. It's free, and it keeps you apprised of what's going on, mostly in IWW news, but sometimes in other union news.
I have another thought.
Go ahead.
So my friend Sarah Morkin, do you all remember her?
I believe so, yes.
Yeah.
So she taught me something wonderful about building actual presence to do things. And what she would do when there was an action or when there was a meeting or something planned is she would find out from people who needed rides. Because not everybody can afford a car.
Good.
I do that for our branch with a couple of fellow workers who live out in Enumclaw.
And our bus system in Tacoma is pretty lacking on weekends. So one thing people can do who are fortunate enough to have a car is to offer rides to people. That increases participation.
Absolutely.
And plus, for those people who tend to be somewhat lukewarm, if they know somebody is picking them up, they're likely to get more involved.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I think something also that, and not to spill too much internal union information, but something that we have also been thinking about as a branch as well, is kind of going off on the idea of having larger social get-togethers. We are also coming up with the idea of having different groups of members in the union who like enjoying certain activities, almost kind of like a hiking club, a gardening club, and kind of bolstering what our creative capabilities are, you know, whether that's creating union-based publications or artwork, whether that's doing a bake sale in the future, things like that, to kind of cultivate a community and a culture of what we can provide for other working people tangibly, whether that's water and food at the picket line, whether that's creating art and having like art drives for fundraising, things like that, or like I said, a bake sale. I think that, you
know, or forming a revolutionary music band.
Yes. I would love to do a IWW choir session at some point. I think someplace like Antique Sandwich would be perfect for that.
Lynn is your person to talk about. You,
you will be our conductor then. Yeah. I hereby denote you as conductor.
I have one last thought on
Ministry
this.
Of Music and Culture.
And it may not be the last thought that we have about this issue.
Mm-hmm.
But I want to step back a minute and acknowledge that some people are not good with face-to-face. Mm-hmm. That doesn't mean they don't care. And some people really benefit from doing online meetings.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And we need to respect that. It's hard for me personally sometimes because I'm so face-to-face with people, but it's important that those people that maybe are not comfortable face-to-face, or for one reason or another, maybe they're physically unable to attend a meeting,
mm-hmm.
that we not invalidate them.
Absolutely.
There's a way that everybody can help. And if they're not forthcoming or don't know in what way they can help, perhaps we can help them find a way,
mm-hmm.
whether it's phone banking or maybe managing a web page or a Facebook page.
Or helping us manage our finances.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, but Lynn is so involved. There are always ways that all of the people who pay their dues or who want to be involved but can't physically have a presence don't invalidate what they bring to the table.
Right, absolutely. And I think that there is, to kind of also have a lateral thought on that as well, this kind of made me think of something. I think that it is good also to kind of highlight the difference between people who, say, join our union and want to be involved but don't really know how to.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, and this is, I don't mean this in any kind of derogatory way, I think that there might also be another portion of people who join the reason, who join the union for maybe ideological or personal reasons. Maybe they want to organize their workplace, but then they are just kind of content having the membership and then doing nothing else to say, I'm a red card holder, I'm part of this organization. I think that those people are a group of people that we should try a little bit harder to reach out to as well, because I think that joining an outfit like the IWW because you believe in its values or you believe in its mission is a good thing. Like, please join up. But on the other hand, just having a red card doesn't mean something is going to happen. You kind of have to do something.
Well, that's a good point.
Mm-hmm. But I mean, no, you're right. I mean, personally, I joined the IWW in March of 2021 because, I mean, especially for a lot of, I mean, for everybody, truly, but I think for a lot of young people who were maybe getting their career started or were just starting out in the workforce, whether that's post-graduation, post-high school, you know, getting into trade school, whatever, we had our lives completely disrupted by something that was A, completely out of our control, and B, very poorly mismanaged by capitalist profiteers and the government for lack of consideration in terms of being protected from the pandemic.
So you're just trying to say in a few words, you were anxious, insecure, and ready to...
Frightened, yeah. I was frightened, and I think especially since the COVID-19 pandemic, so many people have gotten involved in organizing because the material reality of you are this close to being homeless, you are this close to going hungry, these people are making record profits off of your labor,
exactly.
while you're worried about whether or not you're going to catch a disease you might not survive from in the matter of a couple weeks or even a couple months with long COVID. For me, in 2021, I came to the realization of, as hopeless as this situation is, I want to do something about it, even if that only ends up making a small ripple, whether that's just writing a few articles for the Seattle Worker, whether it's producing this radio show. I want to contribute to the betterment of others, especially working people, and I see this organization as my way of doing that.
A thousand ripples make a mighty wave.
Yes, they do, absolutely. So I think in terms of motivating those members who maybe sign on because, I'm a socialist or a communist or an anarchist and I really love the IWW. They have a cool history of like general strikes and mutual aid and all that stuff. It's like, welcome to the team, but what do you want to bring to the table? Because
Here's another thing. I'm taking my cue from because we can learn from other organizations.
Absolutely, absolutely.
TDSA every week puts out a call, who is willing to do this?
Mm-hmm.
Who is willing to do this? And there's something there, concrete, every week that somebody can do.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. And I think that's something that in our outfit we should, you know, try to emphasize a little bit more too, especially for the newer members who might have the fresh energy of, I just joined, I'm excited about doing this. We can be like, great, we have this small task for you to do this month. Mm-hmm. Can you take this on? I mean, in my own personal experience, I have the unfortunate personality flaw of just signing up for responsibilities and then later down the line realizing, oh crap, I'm juggling 10 to 12 balls in the air
There's
at the same time.
There's a theme song for you.
Mm-hmm, go on.
I'm just a girl who can't say no.
Ooh. Yep. Yeah. I am the unionist that can't say no. I mean, I'm assistant secretary. I'm a delegate. Yeah. I do the radio show. I write for, you know, two IWW publications. And so it would be nice if we did, like you said, kind of generate
every
that
week.
Culture of...
Hey, yeah. You can't be a member of TDSA and month after month after month not respond to weekly call-outs for specific actions. You can't.
I can speak to this personally. I keep getting invitations from a fellow worker in that organization, like, our monthly meeting is coming up. Here's a Facebook invitation. Here's, you know, a local volunteer day at our public parks. Here's an invitation. Like, he's a really cool guy, and I've gotten to know him personally. And, well, personally, in the few times that I've interacted with him face-to-face, and he's always been very encouraging towards me.
So can you say no every time?
Well, sometimes I say no, but I've definitely been to a couple of TDSA get-togethers, whether that's mm-hmm. a social or, you know, a
I'm
couple
I'm picking
of
up yard
tickets.
Signs later today.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you got to do something. Even if you're in a wheelchair,
mm-hmm.
you can write for the newsletter.
Right.
Everybody does something.
And on that note, I think that, you know, you can take in both hands, here's how we can accommodate for people who maybe have a disability, who maybe live really far away, who maybe might be yeah. lacking some financial funds.
So
and
I
on the other
we,
hand, we can offer, at the very least, offer tasks that they might be able to do.
So I think we've covered this subject, unless there's anything else.
I think if I was to throw one more note into this, it would have to be that when we talk about assigning tasks, we're not taking on gigantic projects. We're not asking you to run an entire newsletter. We're not asking you to run an entire radio show.
I'm picking up signs.
Or I'm reaching out to a couple fellow workers who maybe went absent or just haven't communicated with us in a couple months mm-hmm. and being like, hey, how are you doing? We miss you at our monthly meetings.
Speaking of
which.
Speaking of which.
Our fellow worker, Mac, has pneumonia.
Absolutely, yeah.
And we definitely want to do a call out for Mac on the radio. We hope you get better fast. And don't try to do too much too soon.
Yeah.
Jimmy Mac, we miss you. Come back. Get better.
I miss him, too. He used to do some poetry on the show several episodes back, and I really loved having him on.
Mm-hmm.
And hopefully we can have him rested and well
We're
again.
Thinking about you.
Absolutely.
Even if you are from Jersey, you're okay.
Especially if you're from Jersey. We're thinking
we appreciate
about
our Jersey fellow workers. Thank you yeah. very much.
Brilliant poet and writer.
Absolutely, yeah. So I don't know. I think that this is a pretty good discussion on a couple thoughts of what can we do to not just get more members, in my air quotes, that the listener
yeah.
can't see, but also how we can better encourage fellow workers to contribute. Because like I said at the start of this discussion, having a red card or having a membership in some organization, whether that's the IWW,
it's good.
The TDSA, you know.
It's good, but we invite you to step deeper into what we're all about.
To yeah. each according to his needs, from each according to their abilities.
Exactly. And to contribute in the ways that you can see possible for yourself, like I said. It's also good to keep an accommodation mindset for this as well, for fellow workers who maybe struggle with wanting to contribute but not really having the means to. So moving forward in our radio broadcast, it looks like up next we have our environmental unionism report. Fellow worker Marilyn, whenever
well,
you're
I'm
ready.
Well, I'm all about one thing today.
Go on.
Sadly, those of you that have kept up to date on the proposed mega warehouse that was being pushed by Bridge Industrial
mm-hmm.
Corporation, it went to city council, and unfortunately the ruling was not favorable. And for those of you that haven't heard about it, it is proposed mega warehouse and parking lots to be built on an aquifer and where the water seeps through the land and gets cleaned as it goes down to fill the aquifer.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, that's the area. The area is a size that if you can picture from Moctezuma's on South 56th Street all the way to Costco, and it did not come down in our favor. But that doesn't mean, oh, by the way, the plaintiff, Earth Justice, and Climate Alliance of South Sound were the ones that brought the suit basically forward. What they wanted was a health environmental impact study.
Yeah, they didn't do one.
And the ruling last week was that there is no significant health impact. So it is not all over. Earth Justice is considering whether they will move forward on appealing this. They did come out with a statement before the ruling that building this property violates Washington's Environmental Protection Act and Equity Act, a SEPA, that's a State Environmental Protection Act, says that they have no ability to rule on health impacts because they're not an equity related agency.
Mm-hmm. What does that mean?
Well, it means that they sure as heck ought to be. They should be considering environmental equity when they're looking at environmental impact. So one thing we need is we need equity language to be put into the SEPA mission statement. That's something that we can push for. We can encourage Earth Justice to move forward on whether or not they take this case on its perceived rule violation of the Washington Environmental Protection Act. Lynn?
Well, to say that there's no environmental impact, so we don't need to do an environmental impact study, it's like kind of begging the question.
Yes.
Who decides that they don't need that? I mean, the law says that you need that.
I mean, this is a huge construction project that's going to be bringing in a heck of a lot more trucking, so that's going to be a lot more
5,000 more trucks a day.
Through one of the poor neighborhoods.
Yes.
In Tacoma.
Past businesses. So it'll ruin the traffic pack patterns past local businesses, past schools, past daycare centers, polluting the air. It's just such a foul thing, but I'm not through talking yet.
Go ahead.
Okay. I know that as a member of Radio Tacoma, we don't do calls to action. That's fine. But I do want to inform the listener that next Tuesday at 747 Market Street, which is where City Council meets on Tuesdays, at 4:30, there will be a rally. And afterwards, if a person wanted to go inside and speak, it happens to be Second Tuesday. And Second Tuesday is public citizen comment. So people have 90 seconds where they can speak their mind about anything that's within the purview of the city of Tacoma. I know that I'm inviting the Raging Grannies to be there.
Mm-hmm.
I'm inviting IWW members and allies to show up. Earth Justice is involved, Climate Alliance of South Sound. There are churches that are involved. We hope to get a really good turnout so that the city can see that the people of Tacoma do not consider this done, because a true health environmental impact study must be done before they proceed with this.
Absolutely. I mean, as I was saying earlier, it's really surprising that they didn't have an environmental impact statement, because like you said, this is on top of a aquifer that's necessary for things like our drinking water and other industrial
uses. They probably
uses
didn't
in that
even
area.
Consult the health department.
Human survival also.
Well, yeah. Small and also traffic safety, you know, increase in exhaust fumes in one of the poorer neighborhoods in Tacoma.
Destruction of habitat. Don't forget
Yeah,
that.
We need another heat island.
Right.
I have a question. I don't know whether you know. What is the area of the aquifer surface as opposed to the area of the warehouse? I mean, does it cover the whole thing? Is there parts not?
You know what? If you go on to either Tacoma 350, or if you go on to Redefine Tacoma, you will probably find that information. They're a little bit more a lot more scientific-minded than I am. Who am I kidding? You know, they're really good at numbers and facts and figures, and I get the story, but I don't remember the details.
Do you have anything more to report for the environmental justice
That's
section?
The main thing I wanted to report, because it's local, and our planet is, you know, in trouble.
Absolutely.
And this is something that we can really work on.
And something that's local, too.
It's not a done deal.
Mm-hmm. I guess to kind of cap off the environmental section as well, I also wanted to give a shout out to our fellow listeners. They're, you know, Halloween's coming up, like you mentioned.
Oh, right. We needed to talk about that.
Right.
Yes.
We wanted to talk very briefly about how to have a more environmentally conscious Halloween experience. Personally, in my youth as well, we would sometimes make recycled or use recycled materials for making costumes, whether that's
reuse instead of the plastic bag, if you can possibly use a paper bag or pillowcase.
I always did a pillowcase just because you can fill it up with more candy. Yeah,
and I know that you have to now, if people come to your door, you can't invite them in and give them homemade treats because everybody's afraid of razor blades. So unfortunately, you're stuck with having to do store-bought candy.
Mm-hmm.
At least try to buy candy that wasn't made by child slaves, please.
Yeah, be conscious of the chocolate that you're buying. You know, remember that, you know, certain candies definitely employ exploitative practices, especially in the chocolate industry, though. Things like Hershey and Nestle and et cetera have been pretty negligent when it comes to protecting children who harvest the cocoa in order to make these candies.
Sealed boxes of raisins would still be a good choice.
My inner child says no, but my adult appreciates the logic where you're coming from.
Never going back to that woman's house.
Well, it's not as bad as getting the toothbrushes from the dentist.
That's fair.
Nice box pencils.
And all I got was a rock.
But you made do.
Yeah. I think also something else to touch on here as well is Halloween decorations. Yeah. A lot of Halloween decorations use a lot of lights, a lot of electronic waste. Especially for lighting arrangements and stuff like that.
At least use LED.
Right. Try to use what you've already bought. And if you want new Halloween decorations, there are ways to make shop from local organic farms for pumpkins. If you want to do pumpkin carving, support those local organic industries.
Use real skeletons instead of the plastic ones.
Yeah. Why don't we use the skeletons of the billionaires? Yeah. For legal reasons, that is a joke. But you know, you can use canvas bags to make jack-o'-lanterns as well, and you can paint those. You can actually make your own like paper mache bones and stuff like that. You know, encourage recycling and reuse of materials.
You know what? I had two boys.
Mm-hmm.
I decided that I would teach them when they started really wanting to drive and they weren't nearly old enough.
Mm-hmm.
I told them that they needed to learn first on a sewing machine how to handle machinery and taught them how to sew on a machine. And they started making their own Halloween costumes.
Wow.
And then one of them got so good at it that he started selling skateboarding outfits and pants so that you could fall and not wipe yourself out. So not only did they gain a skill, but they weren't going out and buying all this expensive stuff.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah, and that's really cool.
And listeners might be wondering why a labor union, a militant radical labor union, is talking about environmental issues. Why do we do this?
Oh, and you're handing it to me?
There ain't no jobs on a dead planet.
That's a fact. Mm-hmm. So don't kill the planet in your haste to enjoy the holidays.
Yeah, no. Just remember this Halloween, you know, try and reuse and recycle as much as you can. Try and make your decorations as environmentally conscious as possible. And we hope that you have fun and stay safe this Halloween.
And if you had a Halloween party for kids instead of the trick-or-treating, which is happening more and more because of safety concerns, then you can do the homemade candies and the homemade treats and not be buying the commercial crap.
Absolutely.
Also builds community.
Speaking of community, coming to the end of our radio show here, Tacoma for All is currently looking for volunteers to participate in phone banking and canvassing events. As we said earlier in the radio show, this initiative one, is going to be coming up on the ballot in November, and the Tacoma for All campaign can use all of the volunteers that they can get. They are going to be having Tacoma for All volunteer days between October 7th and October 20th, and you can find more information about this at everyaction.com. They have a link up here on Facebook specifically titled Tacoma for All Volunteer Days. Please reach out to the Tacoma for All campaign. Please reach out to the Tacoma Democratic Socialists of America if you want to get more involved in protecting the renters in the city of Tacoma, because they can use all the muscle and all the footwork they can get.
You know, I want to bring this full circle because I had volunteered to canvass, and they were getting their canvassing sheets from this thing online. And I could not, as an old person, access this online voter sheet. So instead of doing nothing, I contacted the group and I said, I can't figure this out, but I'd be glad to drive the signs to public places and put them up at intersections. So I could still play a role, even though I wasn't tech savvy enough to do that other part.
Absolutely. If you want to volunteer to get those road signs out, God knows I'll be taking a couple myself. It's also good to do the research on where you can and can't legally post those.
Oh, I know.
What's public land and what's technically considered private property. So please reach out to
Parking strips.
Yeah, please reach out to the people who are organizing these events, because they can give you all of this information so that you can do it the right way. Are there any other local events that you might have heard about coming up? Oh, could you repeat the information about that rally really quickly?
October 11th, next Tuesday, 747 Market Street. 4:30 for the rally, 5 o'clock for the city council meeting. Anybody can speak during public comment period. So let's make our presence very nicely known, very heavily known, very vocally known. Come out and support the warehouse banning and also Prop 1.
Absolutely.
I think it's maybe the 10th. Who can look it up?
Okay.
What the date
okay,
is.
I have to turn this on.
I'm going to go ahead and jump in here really quick as well. Fellow worker Gordon mentioned this earlier in the episode. Coming up next month, on November 11th, we will be gathering in the city of Centralia to commemorate the new plaque that we have for the IWW members who were arrested, killed, and the lawyer that was disbarred that represented them during their trials. That's coming up on November 11th. We will be pending more details on our WOB Radio Facebook page as they come along. We will keep you in touch about that. We would really love to see all of our fellow unionists and pro-labor folks down in Centralia on that day, because this is a very important way to remember the history of fellow workers past who really did fight, struggle, and in some cases even die so that we can have the labor liberties that we have today.
And let me just amplify it that it is still a fraught issue today. This incident happened in 1919, and it still divides the city of Centralia today. The Wobblies down there, who had to work very hard, shout out to Mike and Mary, have been working literally years and years to get these wrongs righted. There's a big monument to the American Legionnaires who started the whole trouble, and the ones who got killed by, you know, self-defensive fire. So they've been laboring, you know, in the vineyards for years and years to get this wrong righted.
Thank you.
I got the date now.
Yeah, could you go ahead and repeat that event information?
I just want to remind the listener, if you're itching to increase your activity level in terms of fighting for justice, next Tuesday, October 10th at 4:30 at 747 Market Street, there will be a rally to protest and let the city know that we do not want this warehouse. We want to know what the city is doing to protect their constituents from this growing hazard. We want to demand a health impact assessment, and we want them to stop, just stop. Protect our environment, protect our citizens, protect our residents. The rally is at 4:30, and then at 5:00, you can go into city council, and during public comment time, you can let the city know in 90 seconds or less, what you would like them to do, how you would like them to increase protection, real protections for the residents of Tacoma.
Thank you so much. Just on one last note here before we close out the show, we'd also like to give a shout out to where we get our labor news. Labor Press Northwest is definitely a big outlet that we encourage our listeners to check up on for local labor organizing and strikes, which are taking place in the Washington, Oregon, and Idaho areas. We'd also like to give a shout out to the Industrial Worker, which is our main union publication out of Chicago. The Seattle Worker that we've also mentioned, we have print copies available through our branch if any fellow listeners want to reach out and get in touch with us at our WOB Radio Facebook page or at the Tacoma branch of the IWW. We'd be happy to give you a couple issues, hand one off to a friend or a family member, or just stick it in a little free library. We'd also like to give a shout out to ourselves. We're very proud to have this union-made, union-supportive radio program that we provide to our listeners, both here in Tacoma and all the way up in Bellingham with KZAX. We really appreciate your listenership, and we hope that you tune in next month. Thank you so much for listening. This has been a production of the Tacoma branch of the IWW. Solidarity forever.
Solidarity.
Solidarity.